The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a one-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.
Football Weekly with James Richardson.
Today, football in crisis special at Etihad. Aguero's mystery injury proves costly for Man City. Mancini reveals the culprit is an aerosol. He was only playing because Sergio couldn't. Meanwhile, Liverpool's back to the club where they got Carroll ends in bitterness when it turns out no one remembered to bring the receipt. With Wolves going down faster than James Perch and Sue Hoops running rings around the Gunners, nailing a three-pointer, there's plenty to talk about from the Premier League weekend. But that's not all. There's Portugal. Pedro Pinto joins us for Superliga talk and special in-the-know preview of Chelsea-Benfica. Sid Lowe hastily ups his game to talk up Barcelona-Milan. Will holding this leg on a football pitch make a difference? There's a rambling bit on Serie A 2, plus Championship, the odd post and more in Football Weekly. Hello, everybody. Very special pod today, then, because, as I say, we have CNN's Pedro Pinto here in the pod, quite literally.
It's a pleasure. I'm a big fan of the show. I'm not just saying that.
Oh, wow. I was going to say exactly the same thing to you. Barry Glendenning's here as well. A bit starstruck, Barry.
I am, yeah. I remember Pedro from... he often presents the sort of Champions League draws and stuff.
He does.
With a glamorous sidekick, I will admit to paying more attention to, invariably. Right.
Pedro, this show's a bit less fast-paced and entertaining than those Champions League 3 special draws that you're used to. But okay. Barry, you were just mentioning the big famous clip of...
James Darrett, our YouTube clip maestro, steered me in the direction of Pedro having a torrid time of it outside Wembley before the FA Cup, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago, Manchester United against Chelsea. Lots of drunken Manchester United fans pouring beer over his head and then snatching the microphone out of his hand. I thought he coped admirably.
Is this your idea of a welcome? Because if it is...
But this was live on TV, Pedro.
It was. I tried to hold it together, which wasn't easy, but I thought if you punch one, you might get a little bit of a backlash from the other 1,000 around him.
Yeah. So. You were mentioning there's another very famous YouTube clip of you.
It's Roger Federer and I recording an interview. I just needed him to sit there and listen to me asking some questions in Spanish for our CNN Espanol network, and he couldn't hold it together. He was laughing nonstop. It's worth it.
For his speaking giggling. Spanish?
Yes.
Why is that funny?
He just thought it was hilarious.
Right.
Some people think Roger Federer is boring.
Yeah. No. Look out for that one. John Ashton, by the way.
Hello, everybody.
Hi, John.
I've got no stories about Roger Federer or having beer poured over my head.
I bet you've got stories about unlikely Norwich strikers, though, haven't you?
Well, I wrote a brief one in our five things, about Aaron Wilbraham.
All right. Well, we'll have a bit more of that later on. So much to talk about this weekend. First off, again, the weekend starting with really sad news, and one hopes for better tidings soon. Stylian Petrov diagnosed with acute leukemia, and really touching scenes during the Chelsea match there at Villa Park. Absolutely best wishes from everyone to him. This is something that, I mean, I think we've seen recently, and players coming back, John Hartson, Abidal so far, things going well there. So hopefully, fingers crossed, we'll get good news about Petrov soon enough. Elsewhere, big headlines, Man City, the draw with Sunderland, Liverpool, the defeat at St James's Park. What are the odds that neither Mancini nor Dalglish will be in their jobs come the summer? Pedro?
Very high.
Yeah?
Yeah. Regarding Mancini, I actually looked back at my blogs this morning because back in January I had said that he was going to be sacked and Mourinho was going to come in.
Right.
And I got a lot of abuse, as you can imagine, from a lot of supporters.
That's
rare
for you, isn't
it? Capacity, but in the verbal channel. So I think he'll be gone. And Dalglish, even being the icon he is, can't survive this kind of record.
I have Dalglish walking out possibly from the toilets at Wembley after a disappointment in the cup semi-final on the 14th. Re Mancini
There's a lot of talk among informed gents that Mourinho's already signed some sort of prenuptial with City. Is that your feeling?
The story broke from Spain on Friday evening. And one of the most connected Spanish sports journalists there said that he had already agreed to take on the Manchester City job starting the 30th of June. I don't know how true that is. I'd give it maybe a 4 out of 10 because he does know his football.
Right.
But I think it'd be a perfect project for Mourinho.
Okay. So, interesting. If Mourinho was then watching the game against Sunderland and making his list of to keep keepers and not keepers, I wonder how many of the team would have stayed in his book, particularly the fellas up front. For example, what would he have made of the enigma that is Balotelli in his performance? Two goals, but all sorts of negative things too.
Well, I find it slightly strange that Balotelli is getting all the blame for this. You know, he scored twice for a start. I mean, obviously, you don't like to see teammates arguing with each other on the pitch. That's never a good sign. But what about blaming Dzeko, who's only not scored 7 games, 5 in his last 26, or the defence, who haven't kept a clean sheet for 6 or 7 games? And Mancini said at the start, or said afterwards, sorry, that he was thinking about substituting Balotelli after 5 minutes, but he didn't. At any point, he took off Silva, he took off Milner, he took off Richards, but he left Balotelli on for the full 90. So there's a sort of contradiction there that I don't quite understand.
There was a moment in Mancini's inter-career when it looked like he'd just got fed up with the whole thing, and then he had that kind of semi-resignation after a Champions League disappointment, and he took it back, etc. It did look, his body language, risky though it is to read things into it, his body language on Saturday did look remarkably similar to that. Like, I can't be bothered anymore with this shower of shambles. I'm heading out of here. I'm better than this.
Well, he stood by Balotelli so often, and I'm not sure what Balotelli did so wrong in the first 5 minutes that...
Well, there was the training ground incident midweek as well. I don't know exactly what happened there, but there was clearly some friction building up before this game even started.
Well, then don't pick him. You know,
he didn't have anybody else, would be his argument.
The fact of the matter is, if you want to put a really positive spin on City's display, you could argue that they show great strength of character to come from 3-1 down. And Balotelli, of course, scored 2 goals, one of which was admittedly only a penalty. But there was a dressing room fracas afterwards between Yaya Toure and Balotelli, which had to be broken up by Kolo Toure. And apparently the players are just fed up with Balotelli, the special treatment he gets from the manager. So the suggestion this morning is that he'll be sold in the summer or possibly sent to Argentina to play golf for 5 months, at which point he'll be welcomed back with open arms. Who knows?
Be interesting if Mourinho does come in, because he and Balotelli had a somewhat fractious relationship. Initially regarded Balotelli as almost a pet project, and then started saying in the press about how Marioni had one brain cell. So, yeah, interesting. But, Barry, we haven't given Sunderland any love for what was a terrific performance.
It was. I mean, for Sunderland to come away from Main Road, or not Main Road, the Etihad, having drawn and being disgusted with that result shows how much in the right direction they're going. It was a splendid performance by them, but unfortunately they didn't have the experience or the savvy to close it out and win the game, which they probably should have done. But Manchester City were pretty lucky to get a draw, and I was pleased with the draw, but disappointed that Sunderland didn't hold on to win, because they deserved to win, I think.
Well, Mancini, despite the point one, was making all sorts of negative noises about title chances. If United win their next 2 games, it's all over, he says. And it is now, of course, out of Man City's hands. They do have the derby against United, but the 3 points there, apparently, not enough. It is worth pointing out, though, that United are going to be playing at Sunderland on the last day of the season.
Is that a question?
No, it's just the noise, really. It's just, you know, last day of the season, Man United at Sunderland, Man City QPR.
For me, there's been 3 reasons why City are not going to win the title, and I've kept them all season long. Their defence just is not up to the standard of the rest of the team, of the squad. The second is that their attacking flow depended too much on David Silva, and he was sublime at the beginning of the year, but physically he's not close to being at the standards they need him to be to run a game. And then it's because Mancini, everyone I talked to who worked with him at Inter, who knew him from Sampdoria, he he doesn't know how to elevate players' motivation levels and to bring everyone together and fight as a team. I don't think he gives enough of himself emotionally to the team to give that extra little 10% that you need to become champions, especially when you have the experience of a Manchester United running against you.
Mm-hmm.
But surely the very fact that they're in contention to win the title should be motivation enough for players. Should it not?
It should, shouldn't it, Barry? It should. Well, there you go. All very interesting with 7 games to go at the top of the table. Meantime, let's move on to Liverpool and the extraordinary match they had there at St James's Park. We probably need to talk about Andy Carroll first off and what may well turn out to be his career-defining moment. Back at the ground where he made his name, threw quite literally on goal an empty net yawning in front of him, and his decision, one, John, that he'll surely look back on and regret.
It was bizarre. It was absolutely bizarre because there wasn't any contact with the goalkeeper. The ball hadn't... Usually those situations, it's because the ball's run away from the attacker's feet and they're just in desperation going down looking for a penalty. But the ball was there waiting to be prodded or poked into the net. And he just, yeah, tumbled down like a dead horse.
Yeah.
It was embarrassing. And he seemed to struggle with the whole sort of occasion, really. He looked a bit upset in the first half after he'd had a couple of kicks. Partly understandable, but then obviously when he was brought off as well in the second half, he wasn't too happy either.
Not too happy, no.
But he insisted he didn't dive, so if you want to give him the benefit of the doubt, he's now at the stage where he can no longer put one foot in front of the other without keeling over.
Mm.
It was a really poor display. And he said before the game that he wouldn't celebrate if he scored, you know, against his old club, presumably in answer to a question, will you celebrate? But, you know, when you're on a run of form as poor as his, that's a bit of a silly thing to say. And it's also quite odd that he wasn't prepared to celebrate in front of them if he scored, but was quite happy to apparently dive and try and gull the referee.
Yeah, of all the clubs to try and cheat against, Newcastle, you know, if you're a former Newcastle player yourself. Now, when we were talking about this morning, we did actually do a bit of preparation. I made the comment that I thought Liverpool were a bit unlucky in this game, and I was poo-pooed, Pedro, quite ruthlessly by the other people there. First off, that handball. I mean, maybe it was difficult for the linesman to see with the post being in the way, but it was clear handball. That should have been a penalty. And also, I'm mystified about the Cisse's second goal. He's yards offside.
I think Liverpool can claim to be unlucky all season long because they have the lowest scoring rate in the Premier League and they've hit the post I don't know how many times, but you can only blame a lack of luck for so long, in my view, and these things happen to every team and it's how you react to them.
In Pepe Reina's case, they reacted in the worst way possible. No place for that in football.
Not even in Spain, in the Spanish papers there, did they really find it much of an excuse for what he did.
Mm. Yeah. Well, they're going to be without him now for 3 games, is it? Including the FA Cup semi-final I referred to before.
But Perch is throwing himself to the ground as if he'd been knotted by Yozard Hughes from Boys from the Black stuff was slightly embarrassing.
It was a bit embarrassing.
Yeah. I can't understand why players do that. Have they no shame at all?
No.
No.
I think that much is clear now, because any time anybody so much as grazes a forehead, the other player will go down, even hard man Joey Barton.
Well, what Reina was expecting, I think, there, what players do is they have that sort of, when you go in for sort of a butting heads together, kind of shouting at each other, but Reina basically wanted to sort of Perch to push back onto his head, and they can have a nice shout at each other, but when you do that, you've got to be sure that the other person is going to want to push your head as well. Otherwise, you can get screwed like Reina did.
It was just a misunderstanding, basically.
Well, Reina misread the situation, clearly. Yeah.
All right. Well, that aside, a lot of people are surprised with the efficiency of Perch's performance at the back there on a day that Newcastle were without Colaccini. Toon Toon says, Perch for England, Christ on a bike. I didn't know he had that performance in him. And I don't mean dropping to the floor quicker than Carroll, etc. Superb at the back, sublime even. Chiote was the puppet master in chief and calmed any nerves I had with Colo. Terrific performance for Newcastle in general.
Yeah, Chiote is a fantastic defensive midfielder. I think one of the best in the Premier League, and they really missed him when he was gone. You can say all you want about Ba, who's curiously stopped scoring since he's come back, but it doesn't matter because Cissé is there. But Chiote is top. Defensive midfielder.
All right, let's get on to the King Kenny, when's he going to go chat then, because this is the big question dominating a lot of Liverpool forums today. Matt Savage, how long until Rafa returns to Liverpool. Simon Frank, though, says, if King Kenny's just a figurehead, where's all the criticism of Steve Clarke and Damien Comolli? All sorts of people that you can point your fingers at.
Well, I mean, I printed off a league table here dating back to the 31st of December, and Liverpool are second from bottom with 11 points, and they're with 8 points, 5 from safety. So their form is very much relegation form. Gary Neville made the point on Sky a couple of weeks ago that they're bizarre to watch because they don't appear to have a plan. He said, you know, if you're going out to play Chelsea, you know what to expect. If you're going out to play Manchester United, you know what to expect. You're going out to play City, you know what to expect. You know, go out to play Liverpool, they don't have any plan or style. Yesterday they had Bellamy playing on the right wing, which was presumably to try and take advantage of Jonas, who was in as an emergency left back for Newcastle. Bellamy was wide on the touchline, did nothing all game. There's no understanding between Suarez and Carroll, and say, unlike Cissé and Ba and the Newcastle players, Ben Arfa was effective. So Newcastle had everything. Liverpool didn't, ironically enough, largely paid for by money given them to them by Liverpool for Andy Carroll.
Yeah, it is ironic, that, isn't it? But is there any particular person you want to point the finger at for all of this? Is it a Comolli issue with the signings that have been made? Is it the fact that the leaders out on the field, the Gerrards, the Carragers, are not holding the team together? It does seem to be a team that is spiralling towards total collapse at this point.
Yeah, as one of my current favourite bands, Doors, would say. They're a Californian Eagles-esque popular beat combo.
Doors without the definite article, yeah?
Yeah, D-A-W-E-S, Doors.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Anyway, they've got a song called It's a Little Bit of Everything.
Right.
Which was a very long way, winded way of saying it's a little bit of everything.
Right.
You can blame, as you say, you can blame Comolli, you can blame his recruitment, because he plays a huge part in that. Dalglish's team selections and tactics haven't been right. But the problem for Liverpool is that they can afford to write this season off as a kind of building season. You know, it's Dalglish's first full season in charge. And if they do get rid of him, or if he does go at some point at the end of the season, then the building process has to start again, so next season becomes a building process. And so how far down the line do you want to go before they're challenging for titles again? They can't keep putting off the renaissance that's never coming.
Well, indeed.
The buck has to stop with Dalglish, and I go back to what Barry was saying. There's no plan. You need to have a plan, and many times you even need a plan B if plan A isn't working. And you can blame Comolli for the signings, but These are players who should have developed somewhat during the season, and they didn't do so. And I think off the pitch, Dalglish has had a disastrous season as well, dealing with the media, with the whole Suarez incident. I am wondering, if he wasn't who he is, would he still be there in a job?
You could probably trace all Liverpool's problems back to the day Benitez got fired, though, because it's just been a disaster ever since. And now, you look at the league table, there's Sunderland, Fulham, Swansea, Norwich and Stoke all have a genuinely realistic chance of passing Liverpool, which would put them down to 13th, which for a club of the history the fans go on about would be an absolute disaster.
And when you don't win your home games, 5 out of 15, it's just not good enough.
But all of this would point to disastrous season were it not for the fact that they won the League Cup.
Well, of course, yeah. And they keep going on as if they've already won the FA Cup. But the way they're going, it's difficult to see them beating Everton in the semi-final.
Well, you know what my prediction is on that, don't you? Anyway.
No, I don't.
Yeah, I said about Kenny walking out after a disastrous...
Yes,
yeah, good. Now, that's it for part one. And plenty more where that came from as we go into part two with a bit of Chelsea Benfica. Chelsea-Benfica. Chelsea with a 1-0 lead in this one. They scored away at the Estadio da Luz.
Great pronunciation.
Thanks ever so much, CNN's Pedro Pinto. And
Portugal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that means a lot from you. And, no, you're looking at me like I didn't mean that sincerely, but I genuinely did. Am I right in saying that was the first time Benfica hadn't scored at home in about 68 games or something that match?
Yeah, it had been a long while.
Right.
Their home form... especially in Europe, has been very, very good.
And their away form in Europe hasn't. So what are their chances of turning this tie around at Stamford Bridge?
35%, I think.
Okay.
Overall, it's not looking good. The manager, Jorge Jesus, he said after the first leg that what Chelsea did in Lisbon, Benfica can do in London. And it's true. They can. They can sit back. They can get some of the possession and grab a goal on the counterattack. I don't think that they're going to stop Chelsea from scoring. So I do see Di Matteo's side going on to the semifinals.
Right, okay. It was a disappointing performance, would you say, from a lot of the Benfica players last
week? Definitely. A lot of the players who have been highly touted, especially in the transfer market leading up to the summer with Nico Gaitan, who's got great skill, but physically a little bit like Silva from Manchester City, has kind of dropped off. Cardozo had a couple of decent opportunities, but if he doesn't have anyone feeding him the ball, he kind of becomes a bit useless. They didn't offer enough. They need a lot more, and they need one of those historic performances to go through to the semifinals.
All right. Do they have precedence this way of times when they've been on the verge of going out of something and this team has come back? And
you know, I remember a game against Arsenal here in the European Cup. That must be like 15, 20 years ago now, when Benfica needed to win by two, and we won by two at Highbury. And I say we because I grew up supporting Benfica and going to Stadio da Luz. But they can do it. There's no reason why they can't do it. I just don't think they will because they're not strong enough. And Chelsea right now seem like they have a very solid unit.
They do, don't they?
Well, I don't imagine it would be a problem in the Chelsea camp directly. But just the vibe I've been getting, just reading reports on the first game and the media over here seem to think the second leg is a foregone conclusion, and I think that could be a mistake to think that. Benfica did not give a good account of themselves in the first leg, and I think if they play well, they could give Chelsea plenty to think about. But then Chelsea's home record in the Champions League this season is perfect.
Benfica warmed up with a big win at the weekend, didn't they, with the former leader Sporting Braga. Hot door knobs says, can we have some love for SC Braga and maybe some insight, Last time I saw them play was when they lost 6-0 at the Emirates, Shamak scored, and then they've gone 13 league wins in a row. This is before they got beaten by Benfica. So 13 league wins in a row and sit top of the Liga ahead of Porto and Benfica. According to ESPN, their leading scorer is an Albanian named Rodrigo José Lima dos Santos, who's never been photographed. Is that true?
No, it's not. Oh. His name is Lima. He's Brazilian. Yeah.
He's
risen to prominence this season. I think Braga's a great story, all right? You have a country that's been dominated by three clubs historically. Boa Vista won the title, Belenenses won the title, and that's it. That's how monopolized it's been. And they've got more Portuguese players week in, week out than any of the traditional big threes. So I think it'd be great for Portuguese football for them to come out on top. I don't think it'll happen, maybe even more for political reasons than football reasons, because you still have the power of those teams with the federation, even maybe with referees with the big decisions. But they've been rising, and of course they reached the Europa League final last year, which they lost to Porto. But great story, and again, being Portuguese, the fact that they've got national players actually on the field makes a big difference for me.
And they're going to be playing Porto next weekend.
Yes.
They dropped to third with this defeat, yeah?
Yeah, but there's 1 point separating first and second, and then another point separating second and third.
Right.
So if they win, they'll go back top.
Wow.
Yeah, great story. I hope they do it. I'm a Benfica supporter, but I hope they do it.
You think the man's going to come down on them? Yeah. It's going to be an interesting game, though. Porto, looking at the top scorers there in Portugal, in Lima Cardoso in there, and James Rodriguez. Hulk, who we see these incredible figures touted for him. He's got 9 all season. What's the basis for the £82 million euro price tag that's been thrown
potential
around?
Hype?
Yeah.
Agents? He's a great player, but on the big stage, I think even in the Champions League, he hasn't been great.
Is it true that Porto lodged an official complaint with UEFA after United fans chanted, "You're not No, sorry, it wasn't United. It was City. Yeah, after City fans chanted "You're not incredible" at Hulk during the Europa League.
I don't know if it actually got to an official complaint. I saw plenty of stories in the Portuguese papers that they were going to do so.
Right,
and then it kind of died down. He's a great player, still very young, but he's been injured in and out of the side this season. That's why his goal-scoring totals are so low.
Oh, okay. That's why. All right. Elsewhere in Portugal, André Villas-Boas, where's he now?
I have no idea, to be honest with you.
He's just gone to ground, is he?
Yeah, he's just kind of sitting on a pile of cash somewhere, I think.
Yeah.
Which he can, because, I mean, I'm sure you've seen in Italy, they're linking him with the Inter Milan job. I don't think he's a very talented coach. He got a lot of things wrong at Chelsea from a personal standpoint, from a media standpoint, but he's still a very talented coach. You don't win 4 trophies in one season by luck.
Mm.
So I hope he comes back. I hope he gets back to the elite level of football.
Mm.
Yes?
Sorry, no, I'm waggling a finger at you now because I'm curious because you say you don't win 4 trophies in one season in Portugal by luck. But before that, you were saying, you know, the weight of the kind of establishment, the footballing establishment, it doesn't come much heavier than Porto. Because people here say, well, he didn't do much. He won a Europa League against weak opposition and he only won that one title at Porto. How big an achievement was it for him winning that title at Porto, in your view?
I think it was a big achievement because you had one of the strongest Benfica sides that you've had in a long while that had won the season prior to that. And Sporting have been mediocre for a while. But I still think it was a great achievement, the whole package. Maybe if you say he just won the league, okay, Porto's won a lot of leagues. He just won the cup, okay, fine. But just the 4 trophies for me is an accomplishment that definitely deserves praising.
All right. Very interesting.
I've got a couple of stats for you.
Stat away.
If you've got time for it.
Yep.
Okay. Last weekend, this is why I'm worried about Portuguese football, okay? Last weekend, the top 3 traditional giants in Portugal had only 5 combined Portuguese players in their starting lineups. And only 24% of the goals this season in the Portuguese league have been scored by Portuguese players.
No way. I bet you got an amazing stat about the Champions League quarterfinals last week.
I do. On that Tuesday, the first leg of the quarterfinals, out of the 4 teams that played, Benfica was the only one without a Portuguese player.
That's crazy.
On the pitch.
But doesn't that mean good things for Portuguese players? They're just not playing in Portugal.
I don't think so. The young players, you know, Portugal reached the final of the Under-20 World Cup, lost to Brazil in extra time. Amazing group of talented players. No one's really anywhere. And it's sad. It makes me sad.
Oh, dear. Barry, cheer Pedro up a bit.
Oh, you're talking to me again now. You're just ignoring John and I because we've got a glamour TV celebrity in. He's handsome, good-looking,
he'll cut
and
me out
famous.
Later. It's just to make you feel good now.
You're just ignoring us. John and I are having our own little chat down here.
Wait, did you want me to come to you with a question about the Superliga?
No, I just wanted to ask Pedro if he prefers Sagres or Superbok.
Ooh.
Down his neck, all down the...
If he had to have any Portuguese lager poured over his head by a drunken football supporter, which would be his shampoo lager of choice?
I would go with Sagres because it's got a name connected to a very historic town in Portugal. There's not a huge difference between both.
Okay. I live in Brixton, which is near Stockwell, obviously, where there's loads of Portuguese people and lots of Portuguese, nice Portuguese bars and restaurants. So I can never decide which I prefer. So
now you know it's Sagres.
Yeah,
because it's connected to historic town.
That'll do. That's good enough for me.
Super, John. Do you have a Portuguese question for
A question? Not a question, but I've got something. I went to the Estádio da Luz a couple of years ago to watch Benfica play Schalke in the final match of the Champions League group stages, which was a dead rubber, which I didn't know before I got there, which was slightly annoying. But it was an amazing night, fantastic stadium. Schalke won, they were great. The fans were fantastic in the Bairro Alto afterwards. But the best moment of the night of the holiday really was I went to a vending machine at half time and paid my €1 or whatever, and it vended 2 bags of Maltesers instead of 1.
Is that common in Portugal?
Does that happen a lot?
In these tough economic times, I think maybe they're doing that to stimulate the economy in some way. I don't know. Give people a little bit of extra goodies.
It could well be the fact that John Ashdown ostensibly stealing a bag of Maltesers
is
what plunged Portugal into financial meltdown.
A butterfly flaps its wings in Tiananmen Square. Yeah, not again. Okay, now, you know what? With all of that, we've kind of run out of time in this bit for our other Premier League chat, so I'm just going to whiz through some of this. We were going to talk about Chelsea and their win at Aston Villa, and Aston Villa, they're sliding towards the bottom three now, just 5 points. Aston Villa, trouble, 5 points. Is it enough, John Ashdown?
Well, it looked at one point like 30 points would keep teams up. But, you know, the results of the last few weeks, you're going to need a little bit more than that. Villa probably only need one more win.
Okay.
And they might get it this weekend. They're at Liverpool, I think, aren't they, where, you know, crisis, take advantage of the crisis there.
Yeah, that'd be interesting. Wolves look like they're down. They're 6 points from safety. Then it's really two from four teams who are all within 1 point of each other. Bolton on 29, then Blackburn, QPR and Wigan on 28. A QPR, with the shock result of this weekend, beating Arsenal. An Arsenal team who'd won their last seven, losing then to a team in the bottom three. I would say it's extraordinary, but that's Arsenal, isn't it? Really?
I mean, it was a horrible weekend for Blackburn.
Yeah.
Because they're sitting at home watching TV, knowing that, in all likelihood, a gubbing is very much ahoy against Manchester United tonight. And then Bolton win, QPR win, Wigan win, and really ratchets up the pressure on them. Roberto Mancini seems to think they'll get a point at least against Manchester United.
But he doesn't know why.
Yeah, neither do I.
No. Well, because, you know, Man United, in the last 11 visits to Ewood Park, have only won twice. So there you go. That's perhaps the reason. But a quick word on QPR. Adel Taarabt scoring.
Love him.
Yeah.
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 It's the kind of players... The kind of player that puts bums on seats?
Yes.
Is that what you say?
Yeah.
No, I like that kind of player.
Are you talking about the fact he's got a chunky backside?
He does have that.
He does, doesn't he? Yeah.
Not as much as Hulk. He's got some junk in the trunk.
Right. Ivanovic, that's another player with humps.
Yeah.
Whatever, bumps. Something like that.
Yeah.
But it's bad news for Downing, that, because he now becomes, Stuart Downing of Liverpool, the player with the most shots on goal without ever once putting it in the net. There you go. But anyway, that, just from QPR's point of view, that's now Liverpool they beat at home, and now Arsenal. And, you know, because everyone says, oh, look, QPR down because they've got to face the top five in their run-in, but it doesn't seem to be a problem for them, John.
And also what was forgotten, I think, when with all that sort of, they've got these big five teams to play, Man City on the final day of the season, I know from bitter, bitter experience that a team going to when a title's already been decided, which it looks like it will be, needing to win. A few years ago, and West Ham went there, and Tevez scored the only goal of the game. That a weakened Man City team will be beatable on that final day.
Interesting. That will be an interesting final day. In other news, in the race for third, fourth, etc., obviously Arsenal slipping up, Spurs with the win against Swansea. Anything we want to say about that, or should we just race on to...
It's a good game. Both teams played well. Gylfi Sigurdsson scored again.
Yep.
Sunderland. Spurs deserved to win, but... Yeah, Swansea were pretty good as well. The Swansea love continues.
Is Spurs' crisis over, you think?
I suppose it looks like it, yeah. I mean, they've got Aaron Lennon fit again. So
that makes a big difference.
But, I mean, their midfield was superb yesterday. Just absolutely magnificent.
All right. Quick word, of course, on the big talking point from the weekend. Fulham-Norwich, John. Now, you posted something very interesting about not only the Norwich goal scorers and where they come from, but also the most unlikely of them all. Do tell.
Yeah, well, the guy who got their consolation at Craven Cottage was Aaron Wilbraham, who was a lower league journeyman who played 400 games for MK Dons and Stockport and little loan spells at Oldham before Norwich signed him last January.
Where'd they sign him from? From Oldham?
From MK Dons.
Oh, from MK Dons.
Where he'd had a couple of reasonable seasons, but you know, this was all at the third and fourth tier level, and he's only made something like five starts since, and he came off the bench on Saturday to score that consolation, which means he's joined that select group of players who've scored in every division.
Nice one. But this is something about Norwich you were pointing out, the fact that their goal scorers come from the...
It's astonishing, yeah. If you look at the... I think they've had 10 goal scorers in the Premier League this season. They've all come from... They've all been signed from sort of Shrewsbury's and places lower down the leagues, Huddersfield and Peterborough and what have you. And it's testament to Paul Lambert's willingness to give those kind of players a chance. He's not sort of gone on reputations. He's gone on. He's trusted his own scouting judgment, not any sort of supposed pedigree that a player has got. And yeah, they've reaped the rewards.
Mm. Rather than spunking 35 million up the wall on some ponytailed loon from Tyneside. Well,
yeah, Grant Holt's the perfect antidote to that, isn't he? I mean, he's a bit of a big lump as well, but he's been. Yeah,
he stays on his feet.
And he's scored plenty of goals as well.
Good stuff. All right, just before we round off for part two then, quick word on the championship. Hey, some big news at the top there with Reading closing in on Southampton with a huge win at Upton Park.
Yeah, they won 4-2 at Upton Park. It was, although they are closing in on Southampton, the bigger picture is the four-point gap they've put between themselves and West Ham for the automatic promotion place. I got a great stat on Reading, which I dug out this morning.
All right.
Which is since the 2nd of November.
Oh.
If all the league table was judged from the 2nd of November, yeah. Reading would be 13 points clear
right.
of the rest of the division.
Were they 16th in the Championship on the 2nd of November?
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah,
they
had a
very slow 16th
start.
At one point, and now they're 2 points off the top. Amazing run they've had under Heston Blumenthal there. The Reading.
Well, it's been
manager.
Fantastic. They've done it in a kind of, yeah, in a, if you like, sort of a Norwich or sort of Swansea or Newcastle-esque way, in that they've
by buying in a player from the Premiership.
No, by not really. There's no sort of. I suppose it's
Jason
kind of,
Roberts.
They've got Jason Roberts, but there's no sort of big stars there, particularly at the moment. I mean,
Ollie Hart's there.
They lost Matt Mills in the summer. They lost. Who's the fella, the striker, Shane Long.
Right. Who won the ropes, John.
Yeah.
Yeah, give it up.
And nobody has scored more than 7 goals, I think, in their entire squad.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a good thing, is it?
Well, there's plenty of players who scored a few goals.
Okay. That's
it's been a collective effort, is what I'm trying to say, James.
Right, part three. Now, Sid Lowe's on a train, which means could be tricky getting hold of him, but we're going to try and do that very shortly. We'll just warm up with a bit of Serie A talk, and of course, a lot of people are looking forward to Milan's trip to the Camp Nou, or Camp Now, as people keep saying. But people keep saying Camp Nou. It's Camp Nou, isn't it, Pedro?
It is.
Yeah. Okay, good. That's confirmed then. But on the subject of the Italian game, a couple of things to mention. One, really sad news. Well, first of all, about Franco Mancini, who you may not recall, but if you watched Serie A back in the 90s, there was a crazy team called Foggia, and we talked about Zeman and all of that. Well, the guy, it was a very short bloke who was their goalkeeper in those days. He had a lot of short keepers in Italy in the 90s. Anyway, he was only about my height, and Franco Mancini was his name, lovely bloke. Used to play drums in a reggae band. I remember he was really delighted when we turned up filming there, because he was in Foggia in southern Italy. I don't think anyone knew what reggae bands were. And so he said, ah, you're from England. So he explained to me about the fact, I'm in a reggae band. Reggae, yeah? But he died of a heart attack. He's only 43 on Friday. And then, Sunday afternoon, Giorgio Chinaglia, who I think we've probably all heard of, the legendary Long John, former Swansea player, of course, won the title, part of that crazy Lazio side in the 1970s, 1973, who did all sorts of kind of things like run with the parafascists and hold up jewellery stores as a joke and get shot by the owners and all that stuff. Not all Canalia, of course, it was his teammates as well, but it was a mad time. And then he became president of Lazio and that went wrong. In fact, most things he did after football went a bit wrong and he ended up on the run in America. Well, he basically couldn't go back to Italy because he was facing charges of money laundering, possibly inadvertently. He was caught up in an ill-fated attempt to take over Lazio, which turned out to be all a bunch of crooks trying to recycle their ill-gotten gains. But anyway, and he was hosting a radio show. He died of a heart attack on Sunday afternoon. Massive figure, though, in the Italian game.
Yeah, and the American game.
He yeah, of course,
spent
Cosmos
a lot of time
as well.
At the New York Cosmos.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, probably people know him more for that, all that kind of once-in-a-lifetime stuff.
He was known for his party lifestyle in the States.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, apparently Harry Redknapp tells a story from when he was manager of Seattle Sounders the Cosmos were playing in Florida and their manager, Eddie Firmani, said, right, there's a big, important game, nobody's going out, and anyone who is caught going out is a $1,000 fine. So Giorgio sort of did a poll of the dressing room, right, who's going out? About 5 people put their hands up. He took a big wad of money out of his pocket, peeled off $5,000, handed it to the manager in advance.
Ah, there you go. Giorgio Chinaglia.
Very fond of the ladies as well, apparently, and a bet.
He certainly lived his life. He died age 65, but he certainly packed a lot of living into those years, for which we can only salute him. Now, on the subject of what happened this weekend in Italy, all sorts of drama and excitement. A lot of goals scored. Milan warmed up for their trip to Barcelona by drawing away at Catania. 1-1 the score.
Which you called?
Which I called. Then it wasn't that much of a long shot, given that Catania were on a terrific run. They'd already held Juve to a draw there, and you know Milan with the Barcelona game hanging over them. But they felt they should have won the game, and Robinho thought he'd scored later on. The ball was cleared off the line, was it? Did it cross the line? Milan then posted a picture on their website, which other people say has been doctored. It's all very exciting. Anyway, but the net result is that Juve, who had a storming win, storming second-half performance anyway, on Sunday night at home to Napoli, a 3-0 the final score there, they moved to within 2 points of Milan at the top with 8 games to go. Del Piero, he didn't score this time, but he was back on the field and he set up Quagliarella for the third goal, and it was a terrific second-half performance. They're now 30 games unbeaten. They've kept 17 clean sheets, I think. All very good. In other Serie A news, all the teams chasing third place, that Lazio, Napoli and Udinese, lost. So Roma, with their massive 5-2 win at home to Novara on Sunday morning, well, Sunday lunchtime, they're now only 4 points off third, so maybe they're joining in on that whole, only the top three get into the Champions League, as you know. And there's a big game there next weekend as Lazio host Napoli. Fiorentina, meanwhile, who managed to lose at home to Chievo, they're in free fall, they're now only 5 points from the drop. Perhaps the biggest news of all, though, in Italy was Inter. You're nodding your head, Pedro, because you know about this one.
Well, it's a great story, isn't it? I mean, Moratti has tried everything, so now the next option is the local kid who's just come up from the youth team, Andrea Stramaccioni. It's a great story. I mean, he's, what, 36 years old?
I don't think he's even that. He's 2.5 years younger than...
Yes, than Zanetti.
Zanetti. I think he's 34, actually, Stramaccioni.
Okay.
Yeah.
And what a game to start
crazy
off.
They go 3-0 up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then just before the halftime whistle, Genoa pull one back. What, Barry?
You're doing it again. You're just ignoring
it. You're still
it
here.
Yeah.
Well, I was ignored during your English roundup.
Yeah.
Which I was hurt by as well.
Yeah.
So it was hurting right here.
Yeah.
I'm pointing at my heart, by the way, not anywhere else.
Nope. Anyway, well, sorry. So, Pedro, sorry about that. Yeah. So then Genoa pulled one back. But it's 3-1. You know, what could possibly go wrong?
You're Inter, so
yeah,
a lot of
Inter,
things go wrong. And you've got a couple of centre-backs who are past their prime. You've got Kivu, who's never been in his prime. And then, 5-4 final score.
5-4. You had two sendings off, including the Juve keeper, Julio Cesar. Did I pronounce that okay?
Yeah, but you did say Juve keeper.
Yeah. What do you want to be calling him?
Inter keeper?
Oh, yeah, Inter keeper. Yeah, that's pronounced very, very wrong. Yeah. Including the Inter keeper, Julio Cesar. And then you had 4 penalties. That's a bit crazy in a game, isn't it? Inter conceding 3 penalties. In fact, three of the Genoa goals came from penalties. But at the end, you know, Inter, you have to say it's a good debut for Stramaccioni because they get their first home win since January. The Nerazzurri. And also, it was very notable how all the players came up and embraced him on the sidelines in quite a genuine manner during this game. So it does speak of a spirit reborn there at the San Siro.
And curiously, Mario Balotelli interrupted that as well.
Sorry. That was really bizarre, actually. Balotelli turning up at the... What was it? What, how did that happen?
He just went back to Milan. He flew in, he got his Ferrari, drove it up to Piano Gentile, and the training ground, and then just decided to show up. Wasn't that nuts? Well, but it is Mario.
It's Mario, yeah. It was bizarre. Yeah, absolutely bizarre. But I don't understand. How did Inter manage to concede 3 penalties?
Well, they just did.
In what fashion?
Oh, okay. Well, Julio Cesar bringing down a player, that was one. Zanetti was a handball, I think, in the area, wasn't it? That was another. I can't remember what the other one was, to be honest, John.
There was no pattern, no sort of...
No, it was just kind of... I mean, they're just rubbish at the back, Inter, and it was quite a... You know, it was one of those games where everything got very stretched out. So, and Genoa, a decent team, you know. I mean, they did well, to be fair, to beat them, even if it was 5-4 after leading 3-0 at one point. Shall we try Sidlow on his train?
Hello, James.
Hey! Well, listen, there's so much to talk about. Do you want to start with the Barca-Milan game, or do you want to start with Real and their 100 goals in 30 league matches, or Athletic Bilbao? What do you want to talk about?
I don't know. I suppose start with wherever you like. I suppose the focus now is the Milan game more than anything else. It's a strange week, this, from a media point of view in Madrid, because, of course, the Apoel game doesn't excite anyone. I mean, there's still 16,000 tickets not being sold. Nobody's particularly excited because they're 3-0 up from the first leg. There's absolutely no doubt where it's going. So with Madrid, the kind of the dynamic at the moment is to look back on the weekend and talk about that goal record and the fact that they're on course for, I think, 126 this season, which would absolutely batter the old record. They scored great goals this weekend. In a weekend when people expected them to maybe lose their grip on the league title, they did quite the opposite. So Madrid, it's all about looking back. In Barcelona, it's all about looking forward.
So how worried are the Catalan press about this game against Milan?
Oh, they're concerned. They're definitely concerned because there's a reaction that while 0-0 is not a terrible result away from home, it's the word they're using is a treacherous one. It's a kind of result that can come and bite you in the arse if you get things slightly wrong. Of course, they're warned by the fact that it was 2-2 in the group stage game that they played at the Camp Nou. And the first time, Ibra will be here. So I think it's the first time he comes back, first time he'll play at Camp Nou since leaving. And everything he has said, calling Guardiola the philosopher, talking about how he thought that Barcelona got it all wrong. And yet the weird thing is that everything he said in his book, which is designed to slag off Barcelona, actually made Barcelona look pretty good and made him look like a bit of an idiot.
Yeah, funny that. Anyway, Sid, I think we're beginning to lose you. Let me ask you very quickly. Barcelona warmed up with a 2-0 win over the fashionable Athletic Bilbao on Saturday. Messi getting his 36th of the season. Who do you think will score? What will the score be on Tuesday?
You mean you're asking me to say something that I don't know the answer to?
Do you think Barcelona are going to be in the semi-finals, Sid?
I think there is a genuine risk that they won't be.
That's true.
It'll be the first time in 5 years because they've been in the last four semi-finals. I think, put it this way, I think they are a better side than Milan. In fact, I think they're a far better side than Milan. I think that's been shown over the three games they've played so far this year. But I think this is on edge. I think Barcelona will be in the semi-finals. But I think there's certainly a big risk there.
Barry?
Well, I'm curious to know how you think it'll go.
Well, I was just about to ask you that question, Barry. But you asked first, so I'll go.
I have a feeling in my bones Milan are going to go through, possibly after extra time or on penalties.
That's very, very interesting. I always feel it's good form to lose or draw your game before a Champions League match, and that, they certainly did that. I don't think it's good to have a big win before you go into a Champions League game. So I actually think that Milan have warmed up in the best way possible. One of the strange things about this, Pato, who's got a terrific record of scoring big goals against Spanish opposition, he scored the first goal in that 2-2 at the Camp Nou. He also scored a very important goal against Real Madrid, I think, the season before. And he's had a terrible injury record all season. Last week, the Milan lab doctors were saying, it's a mystery to us, we just don't know why he's not fit and what keeps going wrong with him. All of a sudden, he's been off to the States and he's come back and then they now see he's past fit for playing. So he's available for selection on Tuesday. I don't know what his form's like or his fitness, but apparently he's available again. So I have a sneaking suspicion about this too, but every logical fibre in my brain says no, Barcelona are going through.
I agree, but I have a feeling Milan are going to go through.
Crazy, crazy football. What do you think, Pedro?
I think both of you are delusional. I think there's no way Antonini and Bonera can replicate the kind of amazing defensive display they had at the San Siro in the first leg. And I think Milan are due a thrashing after somehow surviving at the Camp Nou in the group stage
that.
And even in San Siro. I don't think a thrashing will happen, but I don't think it's going to be close.
Wait, didn't Barcelona survive a first half thrashing? Milan should have been 2-0 up in that game. Apart from the penalty, of course. 2-1 then. 2-1 up in the first.
Zlatan and Robinho should have scored in the first half. But
yeah,
I don't think that would have been a thrashing.
All right, John Ashdown. It's 2-1 to Milan at the moment. Yeah. What are your thoughts on Barcelona, who play Milan this Tuesday?
Oh, do they? I think, I entirely agree with Pedro. It's a Barcelona win all the way.
All right, then. All right, well, that sadly brings to an end a vintage episode of Football Weekly. I say sadly, but everybody seems to be very happy with that news. John Ashdown, Barry Glenn Danning, and many, many thanks to Pedro CNN's Pinto. CNN's Pedro Pinto for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
No, not at all. Been our pleasure. Good. We'll be back on Thursday with our reaction to all the midweek excitement. Have a super time until then.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook when you sign up for a 1-month, no-commitment trial of the Audible service. Audible has over 50,000 audiobook titles available to download. Go to guardian.co.uk/audible for further details.